Cancer affects many people, both directly and indirectly, and whether you have it yourself or know someone who does, it's likely that your life has, unfortunately, been touched by this illness, not really one illness, as many, many, many different illnesses. And to better equip you for the journey, there's a new book out. It's called After You Hear It's Cancer, A Guide to Navigating the Difficult Journey Ahead, written by John and Lori Leifer. They write about the challenges and decisions that commonly you would face as a cancer patient or as a relative or friend of one. And John Leifer with us by phone. John, thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. Appreciate it very much.
Well, my pleasure, Larry. I'm glad to be on the show.
I should mention, John, by the way, that John is president of the Leifer Group. It's a Leawood, Kansas-based consulting firm. And his wife, Lori, is a doctor herself. And so we'll talk about that as we move along through the show. I have to tell you, after going through your book, I've had a couple of friends who have had to deal with cancer. In one case, it didn't turn out well at all. The other case, the person's in remission. But in both cases, I wish I'd had your book to give to them when they first learned they had cancer, because I think it really does provide a lot of information, useful information to people in that situation.
Well, I appreciate that. I think the journey through cancer is a very, very arduous one, and one that we're all pretty ill prepared to take. It's not something that we ever anticipate, even though it's going to affect about 40% of the population. And our hope is that this book is a very effective guidebook, and perhaps it can make a difficult journey a bit easier.
Yeah, and I like the fact you called it a journey, because really that's what it is, isn't it?
Well, it is a journey. In fact, it's more and more a journey as cancer kind of goes from a very acute disease into a chronic disease, and we're able to treat people for extended periods of time. I mean, people live with cancer much, much longer, and they enjoy oftentimes a high quality of life. So this is a journey that you embark on without really knowing what the final destination is. You don't know what the length of the journey will be, and you just pray that it's a positive outcome.
Yeah, and it's easy to see your motivation for writing this book.
Well, my motivation was multifold. The genesis of the book really was the many, many conversations that Lori and I would have at the dinner table after work. And Lori would talk about the travails for patients, and not just the physical challenges that they faced, but the emotional or psychosocial challenges, and even some very basic kind of functional challenges, like paying for treatment, the ability to afford it, and what they might have to forego in order to be able to pay for their treatment. And as I listened to these stories over many years, I mean, there was a part of me that it gripped my heart, and I wanted to be able to do something about it. And as the non-physician in the family, I sort of scratched my head and said, what can I do? I thought, well, I can write the book, and I can use Lori as my expert resource and to validate that everything we're saying is clinically appropriate and accurate. And hopefully we can give people something that will have utility and that might just improve their quality of life when they're dealing with something very difficult.
And then you're Lori herself, someone who treats people with cancer, has cancer or had cancer herself.
Well, I guess sort of negatively, serendipitously, if that's an appropriate expression. Lori did develop cancer. In fact, it was on Easter 2013, and Easter is an incredibly important sacred day to my wife, and one that generally brings great joy. But that night, I remember going to sleep a bit ahead of Lori, and then I was awakened to hear my normally reasonably stoic wife quietly sobbing in the bed, and like any good husband, I said, "What's wrong? What did I do?" And she said, "I found a lump in my breast, and it's 2 centimeters, and it's cancer." And I think at that moment, I probably prayed more than at any other time in our lives together that she was wrong. And unfortunately, she's a very good diagnostician, and she precisely diagnosed her cancer. So, yes, that was kind of an odd synchronicity that happened as we were working on the book, and it helped inform the book, because not only did we have Lori's clinical expertise, but now we have the shared journey of cancer together.
I want to give our listeners a chance to join in before we go on, John, and invite you, as you listen to the show, have you or someone close to you been diagnosed with cancer? What's your experience been? If you or a loved one has lived through a cancer diagnosis, what would you want others to know? What helped you get through daily life and keep some semblance of normalcy? What was good, quote-unquote, and maybe what was bad about the whole experience? Join in. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@WPR.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. We'd certainly love to hear from you and hear about your own experiences. And John, maybe I love how you've organized the book, and I love the fact that you use examples. And please go ahead and explain to our listeners how your book is organized.
Well, the book is organized into three sections. So the first section is about diagnosis, prognosis, and treatment planning. And I think it's an incredibly important section for people who are newly diagnosed, who have recently heard the word cancer. And they're probably reeling emotionally. And it's a time when our normal thinking processes are clouded by just overwhelming anxiety. And yet it's a time when people need to slow down. They need to be very, very methodical about how they proceed. As Lori and I say, you need to take your foot off the accelerator. This is a time to very carefully select your care team, to understand your treatment options impeccably well, and then to make the right decisions for you. And hopefully the book can give you some very clear guidance on that. The second section of the book deals with active treatment. So once you've selected a treatment or agreed, collaborated with your physician and agreed on a treatment plan, what can you expect? And so it deals with things like side effects. And these could be the short-term effects of surgery or radiation or chemotherapy, or they could be ultimately long-term after effects that you may incur. But really, what can you do to mitigate the negative impact of side effects or minimize it? We talk about the financial aspects of cancer, because that's just a reality of cancer treatment. It's an unfortunate reality, and it's something that frankly is becoming more problematic as the cost of cancer care escalate dramatically. And we talk about a variety of other things, including everything from clinical trials to complementary medicine. So it's relatively comprehensive. And then finally, the third section of the book deals with what happens when your initial treatment fails, and so you reach a critical juncture in the journey, and you have to make tough decisions regarding future treatment and what treatment options are available. And ultimately, the journey bifurcates, and one either is going to be a survivor, quote unquote survivor, or one is going to be dealing with palliative and hospice care issues. Yeah. And we try and deal with that as empathically as we can.
Yeah, and you do. I think you do a wonderful job of that.
Thank you.
With my own experiences with friends and family members, I thought, boy, you've been spot on certainly spot on with your recommendations and with your stories. And I like the fact that you had, there are stories about individuals in every chapter that bring the information to life.
I thought that weaving in some of the case studies and doing it in a very personal manner would just hopefully make the book come a little bit more to life for people, so that it wasn't just research facts and it wasn't just processed information. It was really, it had some heart to it. And the people that we interviewed were very diverse, not only in terms of the type of diseases that they had, ranging from prostate cancer to breast cancer to head and neck cancer, but also demographically and professionally. So we have a postal worker, and we have a college professor. We have, a pastor of a church.
Yeah.
And we have one of the founders of a major bioethics center. So I think it does add a kind of texture, emotional texture to the book that's very important.
I agree. Many callers. In fact, every one of our lines is filled right now. So let's go to the phones and hear what is on people's minds. Mike in Eau Claire, Thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Hey, good morning, guys. Many years ago, I almost lost a friend to testicular cancer. We were playing baseball. He caught a ball down there, and you know, normally you walk it off, and 3 days later, he was getting worse, and we learned all about that. And since then, I've been checking myself. In June, I was checking myself in the shower, which I did about once a month, and there was a lump. And I just froze. You know, you go in shock. Oh, my God, not me, et cetera. And, yes, it was me. And I had the very evil internal melanoma after all the tests and biopsies and everything else. A scary time. But, guys, check yourself because I caught mine early enough. I am now 4 months cancer-free.
That's very excellent advice, isn't it, John?
Absolutely. We have to be our own best advocates, and we need to be doing everything we can to check ourselves, be mindful of the potential for disease. If we find something, yeah, it's going to be scary as hell, but we still have to deal with it and deal with it promptly.
Yeah, and especially for some reason, and maybe it's true of women too, but guys, there are guys I know that are just don't go to the doctor. Your arm has to be falling off or something before you go, if you find something, you should go in and find out whether or not it really is cancer or whatever. Mike, thank you. Yeah, I'm sorry. Go ahead, John.
Well, I was going to say absolutely, and realize that oftentimes things are quite completely benign, or the things are discovered at an early enough stage where they're easily treated.
Yeah, absolutely. Again, Mike, thank you for calling. I'm going to give Chris a chance to join us in Madison. Chris, thank you for calling.
Oh, yeah, thanks for taking my call. A year ago, Thursday here, my dad passed away from liver cancer, but also had actually beat pancreatic cancer. And I just kind of wanted to pass along what I learned through both those processes was that, it was very much a group effort with my mother and my sister and I, surrounding my dad, but that we really asked a lot of questions. You know, earlier in my life, I would always take what a doctor said as the final word and never question it. And I really learned over time that, you know, number one, you know, it isn't always the final word. Yeah, they're great doctors and they made the right diagnosis, but, you know, they're not always correct, or what the course they recommend might not exactly be the right thing, and it is okay to question doctors and question things all the time. And I don't mean it in a combative way at all. I just mean that you're advocating for whoever that person is, and don't always take everybody at their word.
You know, thank you so much for calling, Chris. And those are words that are echoed in your book, John.
Chris, those are absolutely wonderful comments. The only doctor who is perfect is my wife. So therefore, you should be asking questions. And Lori and I say that an informed patient is an empowered patient. And it's not just the patient. It's the familial caregiver who should be asking questions as well. So when you look at your interaction with your doctors, the word that I would use is collaboration, not deference. So your job is not to defer to their judgment, but to collaborate with them and to be informed enough to make the right decisions for you.
And I one of the helpful things I found in your book, John, was the fact that you have places in the book where you have sets of questions, that potential questions that people might ask, so that you give them some clues as to, you know, things to think about.
Well, yeah, fortunately, most of us don't encounter the healthcare system that often. And so we don't, you know, innately know what questions to ask and sort of what's fair game or what's going to yield the most important information for us to process. So, you know, I have tried to list out what I think are the critical questions at given points in the journey through cancer.
And, you know, going back to Chris's comments, another thing that you note in your book is, depending on which doctor you talk to, he or she is likely to recommend or talk about the things that they're most comfortable with, that they're most often work with. So sometimes getting second opinions is a very useful and worthwhile and necessary thing to do.
Well, absolutely, Larry. I mean, way, there is specialty bias. So a surgeon is going to be biased to think in terms of what can be surgically removed, or a radiation oncologist will think about what he or she can treat effectively with ionizing radiation, et cetera. So you need to factor that in. And I think this issue of second opinions is very, very important. There's almost no case where a patient can't benefit from a second opinion unless it's a very simple early-stage cancer. I mean, you know, someone's probably not going to get a second opinion for a basal cell skin cancer.
Right.
But you know, for even for stage one breast cancer, you could get very different opinions. Or, you know, a type of breast cancer called DCIS, which is very controversial right now. The opinions could vary from no treatment or watchful waiting to a mastectomy.
And one of your one of the doctors you quote in the book said that he really appreciates it when patients ask to get a second opinion, because he said that helps him to gives him a whole another take on the potential situation.
Absolutely. I think that patients are afraid that they're going to insult their physician, that by asking for a second opinion, they're somehow questioning the physician's judgment or wisdom. And what they're simply trying to do is get additional information because, you know, there are multiple ways of treating cancer. People may look at pathology results differently. It's another set of eyes to look at something and say, you know, I have a slightly different opinion on this. This is how I might go about treating it. There's another point that I want to bring up, though, because, you know, when patients hear differing opinions, it can be very confusing. And if Dr. A recommends radiation and Dr. B recommends surgery, they kind of say, well, does that mean I need a third opinion? One of the things that patients can avail themselves of is a website, which is nccn.org. And that stands for the National Comprehensive Cancer Network. What they will find there are the standard pathways for treating different types of cancer. So you can go in, and in reasonably consumer-friendly language, you can look up sort of the consensus opinion on how early-stage lung cancer is treated, or how, stage 2C breast cancer is treated. And that tells you that this is the normal way of treating this disease, and if your physician is recommending something that deviates from the standard, perhaps you should politely be asking him or her why.
Oh, that's very, very good. John Leifer, our guest today, he is the co-author with his wife, Lori, of the book, Dr. Lori Lindstrom, of the book After You Hear It's Cancer, A Guide to Navigating the Difficult Journey Ahead. He just mentioned the website to go to, and Rebecca Haas has already got that up on our Facebook page, or just posted it. So if you didn't get that down, you can go to our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show and get it right there. You may have a question for John Leifer. I hope you'll join in. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Go to our Facebook page as well. You can post there at The Larry Mueller Show. That's the title of the page. I'm Larry Mueller. Rebecca Haas, our on-air producer on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Right now, visiting with John Leifer about the book that he wrote with his wife, Lori, called After You Hear It's Cancer. And lots of callers online, as I expected. We were going to have a busy day today. And Marty in Milwaukee's been waiting a bit, so let's go there. Marty, hi. Thank you for calling.
Thank you for having me. I'll try to be as quick as I can. I'm going to end up with two pieces of advice, which is only half as many times as I've had cancer. I'm battling my fourth cancer now, and partly because I have a genetic predisposition to cancer. So my first piece of advice is, if you have family members who have had cancer and you have any reason to believe that there may be a genetic component to that, then you have to up the ante in terms of making sure you get preventive care. And that's probably what helped me survive the very first time around when I had colon cancer, because I had the example of my mom and a cousin who actually passed away. My mom survived. Nevertheless, that got the doctor on a horse to get going, you know. Secondly, the earlier caller said be willing to change providers. And after the third cancer, I think I was very keen on finding out if my particular genetic predisposition had any link to pancreatic cancer. And I was assured that was not the case. So when I was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer, it's now locally advanced. The first round of chemo has not worked, but I'm on a clinical trial, which I'm very hopeful for. But once I learned that, my wife and I both decided to go to a different facility, which has been absolutely incredible in terms of the care. They've put my case in front of a conference a number of times. There's a medical college on campus, so it's been extraordinary. But don't hesitate to look around after the, because I'm loyal to whoever's been taking care of me.
Yeah. Excellent. Thank you so much for your comments. John, a comment from you?
Actually, several comments. First of all, on the importance of genetic testing and also sort of understanding the family genetic profile. I'm sorry that Marty is struggling with yet another cancer, but I very much appreciate his points, and particularly this point about understanding if you are at special risk. So, for instance, people that have mutation of the BRCA, the BRCA1 or BRCA2 gene, are at significantly increased risk for a variety of cancers. I mean, for women, it would be breast or ovarian. And there are clear steps that can be taken for people that are, you know, BRCA positive to mitigate that risk. Marty also talked about variations in the capabilities of different facilities. And I think the variations can be profound. And so, for instance, the services that you might find available at an NCI-designated cancer center may be very different than what you find at a community cancer center. Now, I can't state that categorically because there are many excellent community centers. But NCI-designated centers oftentimes have just a greater level of subspecialization. There is the ability to present cases in a tumor conference. And so you have the benefit of multiple subspecialists reviewing your case at one time. So I think all of his points were excellent.
Yeah, and in your book, he mentioned clinical trials, and in your book you go into a discussion of clinical trials.
The comments I would make about clinical trials, there are several. One, it's something to ask your physician about at the time of diagnosis, because a number of trials will no longer be available to you once you've embarked on a certain treatment path. So you need to find out whether or not a clinical trial is a potential opportunity for you at a very early stage. The second comment would be, the primary reason to engage in a clinical trial is to further medical research and really to pay it forward. What is the greatest gain will be to patients coming down the line who benefit from the increased knowledge resulting from a clinical trial. If a clinical trial happens to it somehow proves to be the silver bullet for your particular condition, then you are incredibly lucky, and it's a wonderful gift. But that's not the primary reason for engaging in it.
All good, great comments again from our callers as well. Patricia in Colgate, thank you for calling.
Hello, this is Patricia, and I'm from Colfax.
Oh, Colfax, sorry.
Yeah, Colfax, Wisconsin, and I'm glad that you accepted my call. And my comment is that the whole process of being diagnosed with cancer and going through your treatment and everything is and can be a very emotional roller coaster. My family, some of the members of my family embraced me. Others acted as if I was a leper. And so that was very emotional. And I didn't connect with any of the cancer groups. And thinking back now, because this all happened, I had my cancer and my treatment like a little over a year ago. I think that you need support, and I should have joined one of the groups because there's different cancer groups throughout the state and in different locations. And I think that would have been very beneficial for me, but I sort of went it on my own. And it was difficult, but I write a lot, and so I wrote a lot about it, and I kept a journal, and that was very helpful.
Oh, thanks for your comments, John. A comment?
Yes. In fact, I devoted a chapter to the emotional roller coaster of cancer, and I actually went back to graduate school to study the psychosocial impact of cancer. So this is a keen area of interest for me. And what I would say is that there absolutely is an emotional roller coaster, and you can't control how people are going to respond to you. That's probably the next book that I write, is how to treat people you love who have cancer. But in terms of this roller coaster, there are things you can do. And Patricia, you talked about the importance of a potential importance of a support group, and I strongly advise people to look into that. There's also, of course, counseling, and that could be with a social worker or a psychologist or pastoral counseling. There are interventions from the field of positive psychology. So things like you mentioned journal writing, that's a great example. And finally, there are also medications. So if the anxiety or the depression really becomes unmanageable or is affecting one's quality of life, there are ways of treating that very effectively.
Yeah. Patricia, thank you so much for calling. And Linda and Cable, thank you for calling.
Hi. So many years ago, I had the boob cancer, and they said, you need to take them off now, both of them, even though it was only diagnosed in the right. They pushed a person through it so fast, I didn't even have time to think about it, to debate what do I want to do, because I'm like a shirt-tail hippie. I like alternative things. I thought of running to Mexico to the biomedical center. I don't like surgery. I don't like poisons. I know it's got its place, but so I succumbed to their pressure, and half of the chemo, it was 8 treatments. I refused the 80 treatments of radiation. When she hacked them off, I looked like a sow ready for a bunch of piglets, you know. It was just a horrid hack job. So I went to a specialist. He straightened it out, analyzed the tissue, and said, did you even have cancer, whatever you're doing? And at that time, I had run to Mexico, got on the Hoxytonic, kept going with that. And then after that, I got diagnosed with the girly organ cancer. They said it was stage 2, grade 3, really bad. You're going to need chemo. Get it all out. Take it out. I said, if it's not affected, the eggs and tubes, leave them alone. And I want to go through menopause normal. Nope, take it all out. They took it out. I begged them to, I went to 3 different places, Ashland, Marshfield, Mayo. Pretend I'm a new person at Mayo. Do a new scraping. Do a new, I want a third opinion. I want, pretend, no, we're going to use the same diagnosis. We trust the radiologist, yada, yada, yada. They took it out, and the surgeon came in and goes, guess what? You never had it.
Oh, my goodness me. What a story, John.
That is quite a story. But there are a couple things you brought up, Linda, that I want to pick up on. One is just to reiterate the message of don't be pushed into any kind of treatment. People need to take their time. They need to understand their options, and they need to give truly informed consent to their doctors. In other words, they get it. They understand exactly what's going to be done. They've selected this option, and they understand the potential ramifications of that option. But I also want to caution about alternative treatment, because I'm not a supporter of alternative treatment. I am a strong supporter of complementary medicine, and here's the difference to me. Alternative medicine suggests that you're going to forego traditional Western medicine in favor of something that has a less than scientific basis, and which is what Stephen Jobs did. And I think one runs a tremendous risk in doing that. By contrast, complementary medicine means that you're going to engage in things that are non-traditional, like acupuncture, meditation, massage therapy, Reiki, that in addition to your standard treatment. And I see those complementary modalities as potentially having a very positive impact on people's quality of life when they go through treatment. It may not change the trajectory or arc of their disease, or it may. We don't know that scientifically. We don't know scientifically whether it does or not, but we do know that it can have a big effect on reducing pain, controlling nausea, making the person feel more relaxed. So, again, just a strong differentiation between complementary and alternative medicine.
Yeah. Linda, thank you again for calling. I'm sorry for the experiences that you've had. And I think I don't know if this has changed, John. Do you think much? Linda's was many years ago, and I think, you know, many years ago, you just, and frankly, even today, for a lot of it, you don't argue with the physician. But books like yours are I think, helping people take a different point of view on that.
Yeah, Larry, I wrote a book in 2014 called The Myths of Modern Medicine. And it looked at these kinds of issues in tremendous detail. And it's a bit of an indictment of our healthcare system. And it talks about how challenging it can be to get the best care available. And, you know, it's a less gentle tone than one finds in After You Hear It's Cancer, but I think it's also another resource that people may want to take a look at.
Yeah. Thank you again for calling. I appreciate it very much. Angel, thank you for calling. Hello.
Hi. I had a family member who has now actually been treated for cancer.
Yes.
And he's a survivor. And so I got a phone call when I was like 10, and he called me up and said, "Honey, do you know what cancer is?" And I said, "Yes." And he says, "Well, I'm sorry to tell you this, but I have cancer." And I started crying because he's one of my very close family members, and I was scared that he was going to die from it. And I go down there every year for Christmas and summer, and I went down for Christmas, and that week that I was there, he got really sick, and he had a doctor's appointment to go to the hospital and get chemo done, and I was sitting at the house with my other family members waiting for him to come home. And when he came back, he had to lay in bed because he was puking and all that fun stuff. And when I went back home, I got a phone call like a year later saying that he was cancer-free. And now I went down there during the summer, and he is all well, and he's doing very good.
Well, that is a nice story, Angel. And there are positive outcomes, John.
Absolutely. And there are many, many positive outcomes. And fortunately, there's been great progress in treating a lot of different types of cancer, and for which we're all grateful.
Thanks for sharing your story, Angel, with us. And Mike in Madison has something to share as well. Hi, Mike. Thank you for calling.
Thank you. Thank you for the program. It's very interesting. 4 years ago, I was diagnosed with prostate cancer. Prostate cancer has been a real bad one overall compared to others. About 220,000 men get diagnosed every year with prostate cancer. Roughly 27,000 die, so like it's 10%. But my experience is I went to a urologist, and this is when I lived in Colorado, and because my PSA went from normally is around 2 to 3, and went to 4. And I called my primary care doctor, and he says, "You know, I'm not too worried about that, but if you want to see your urologist, you feel free to do so." He said, "And let me know what they say." Urologist wanted to do a biopsy, prostate biopsy, and which is uncomfortable, but it's manageable. And he found my Gleason score, the score by which they record these, was 6. And he said, "You know, you're a little bit high there." He said, "I'd like to refer you to a radiation oncologist for further evaluation." And long story short, I didn't know this, but they were buddies. And these two people, the radiation oncologist and urologist, they referred back and forth to each other and always told good things about it. The radiation oncologist, even though my PSA was now at 4, said, "I think you need seats." I said, "Really?" And so we discussed it. And went back to my primary care doctor, told him all this, and he says, "If I were you, I wouldn't worry about that. Don't do seeds." And he says, "Unless it spikes." And to him, a spike was over 10. If it goes from 4 to 10, something like that, that's a spike. Then you want to be concerned what to do. So I decided to see 4 other doctors. 3 of them were urologists and another different oncologist. All 4 of them said, "You don't need to be doing seeds. Unless it spikes, don't get too worried about it." So there are a lot of variations there of doctors' opinions. And the radiologist, oncologist that recommended seeds, my very first visit with him, it wasn't more than 15 minutes, and he was going to set me up on an appointment. He called me twice at home 2 weeks later and asked me.
I'm going to break in just because we're starting to run out of time. John, a comment from you?
Yeah, quick comments. Prostate cancer, most men die with it, not of it. It's incredibly common as men age. It's very indolent or slow growing, and it's perhaps one of the most overtreated cancers in America. So for many people who have prostate cancer, depending again on what their scores are, the Gleason score, the PSA, the most effective treatment is watchful waiting, not actively going in and treating it.
Yeah. Mike, thank you for that. I want to give Barb in Cumberland a chance to join us, too. Barb, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hello. Hi. Thank you for having the show. I'm actually a cancer survivor, had breast cancer 3 years ago, went through surgery, radiation, and a year of chemo, and am 2 years free now. I'm also a physician, and so I've had the unfortunate opportunity to tell many people they had cancer. And it certainly gives you a different perspective once you've been through it, but I just want to say I'm off today after working last night and listening to the show here. It's wonderful to have a book like this to give you kind of a roadmap for people, because as a physician, you'd think, oh, I know how to go through this. It's a different animal, so it's, I appreciate your book.
Oh.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. And John, and by the way, the book, again, titled After You Hear It's Cancer, John Leifer with his wife, Lori Lindstrom Leifer, Dr. Lori Lindstrom Leifer, are the authors of it. And I guess, John, in the last minute, what would you like our listeners to take away from your from all this, from your book?
I would like for them to take away the incredible importance of being informed as you go through this journey. That the more information they have, the more empowered they are to make smart decisions collaboratively with their doctors. I'd want them to know the extraordinary importance of hope while going through this journey. And in fact, the closing comments of the book talk about the importance of holding on to hope. That there's always a reason to find hope. And that I, Lori and I wish people well that are going through this, and we understand how difficult this journey can be. And I'm also happy to hear from people. And if there's ways that we can provide information or anything else, we're glad to do it.
And do you have a website, John?
Yes, it's the book title. So it's www.afteryouhearitscancer.com. And I'm also happy to share my email, Larry, if that's appropriate.
Sure, go ahead.
Sure, it's just J Leifer, so JLEIFER at Leifer, LEIFER.com.
Thank you so much, and we'll be posting all that information up on our Facebook page. John, it's a pleasure. I hope we have a chance to talk again.
I sure appreciate it, Larry. Thank you very much.
Yeah, appreciate it. Appreciate your time. John Leifer is president of the Leifer Group. It's a consulting firm in Kansas. He and his wife, Lori, Dr. Lori Leifer, have written this book, After You Hear It's Cancer, A Guide to Navigating the Difficult Journey Ahead. And as I said in the beginning of the show, it's a book that I'm hanging on to, maybe for my own reference. I've already read it, but if I have an occasion to have a relative or friend with cancer again, that's probably the first thing I'm going to hand over to them is that a copy of that book. And there's another book I want to talk with you about as well, dealing with not cancer, but it's called Come Let Me Guide You, A Life Shared with a Guide Dog. Susan Krieger, our guest coming up next, to talk about her experiences with her guide dog and dogs, actually. Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.